Access number 29537, Mr. Albert Arndt, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about, we've just done the transmitter. Now, the other one, what's the other wireless room for? It says it's a listening room. What's that?
Yeah, the other was the listening room. Was just as you come in the door to the left, there was that quite a big apparatus, the listening apparatus, which had a handwheel on. In front of you was a dial, so when you turn the handwheel, you see the hand on the dial, which was about 10 inch in diameter, I would say, that moved round from zero to the right, round back to 360 degrees. So when you had to do your listening, you had your earphones on, and you turned that wheel very slowly, and the hand on the dial went slowly round, which gave you then, if you did hear something and you had to report it, you could say at 45 degrees noises, propeller noises, or whatever the noises were. And when you were actually on duty, you had to do nothing but sit in there with your earphones on in quietness and slowly sweep round 360 degrees, and that you had to do for 4 hours duty. And whenever you heard something, whatever it was, you had to report it. If it was something recognized as important, sometimes the captain or one of the officers came and listened in as well. And then they made decision accordingly. There were also in the same room, on the opposite side from that listening device, was of a shelf like a table where you could do your writing on it, whatever it had to be. There was also the radio, which you could listen to, which you could switch through the whole boat. There was also a record player. And then there was a shelf, or sort of a cupboard, full of records. Because in your spare time, sometimes the crew liked to listen to a bit of music, and according to whatever, you got to know what they liked. And sometimes the officers ask you, could you put on that record, or could you put on that music? That is what we did. And there was also, on the bulkhead, was a big fuse box, where there were lots and lots of fuses in controlling, especially the listening apparatus.
Now, this listening apparatus, is it wireless or is it acoustic?
It's acoustic.
I thought it was. Yeah,
it is acoustic. Yes.
And that's
because as you know, sound travels better and quicker through water.
So it was. This was what you'd been practicing with the records with.
Yeah,
for use of that.
That's right.
Now, just in more detail, what about the weapons on the ship? If you could just review them for us. So you have your torpedoes. You've got one at the rear and four at the front.
We've got four torpedo tubes at the bow and one torpedo tube at the stern.
Now, what size were they?
21 inch.
And how many?
You were provisioned, and you had all your weaponry and ammunition supplied. You had four torpedoes in the front, in the bow torpedo tubes. You had one in the stern torpedo tubes, that is five. And we had, I think, two under the bilge at the stern, spares. That makes seven. And we had four torpedoes, spare torpedoes, in the bow torpedo room. There were two, I think, either side, under the floorboards, in the bilge, if you like, and two were actually on top, under the, you know, where you sleep in.
Now, any other, did you have a gun?
Oh, yes, we had I would say it's a bit of a guess now. Up to 1942 or so, submarines used to have a gun, whether it was an 88mm or 105mm gun, in front of the conning tower, which became obsolete because you spent most of the time underwater anyway. We had our boat, which was a 7C boat. 7C41, yes, that was the type. We had, at the rear of the bridge, we had two twin 20mm anti-aircraft guns. That means, you know, four barrels, two twins. And then there was a step down, which we used to call the winter garden. There was a 3.7mm anti-aircraft gun. That was the weapon we had.
Now, I'm not sure what happens next then. Because there is a difference between how you remember it now and how you wrote it down. But
yeah.
So what do you remember has happened? Is it on the way back from Hela that you
yes,
you have this accident?
Yes, once we had completed the trials and whatever was necessary, we went back. We were back ordered back into Kiel, and on our way to Kiel, I don't know where it was, there was suddenly an enormous crunching noise. Nobody knew what it was because there was nothing to hear on the listening device. It was absolute silence. There were no propeller noises, ship noises. There was nothing at all. And the officer on watch on the periscope, there was nothing to see. Right? And suddenly there was that crunch. A real crunching, tearing noise. We were underwater then, of course. Nobody knew what it was. The boat shook. So eventually there was again a short time of silence. We had to listen again, sweeping round. The periscope could not be used because it didn't exist anymore. We surfaced. We had difficulty open, you know, the... why can't I never remember the name?
The bulkhead doors, or the hatch.
It was very difficult to open the hatch because it was jammed, it was obstructed by something. But eventually, the officer opened the hatch, and we were on the surface, and behold, it was such a mess. Both periscopes were bent over towards the bow. One side of the conning tower, all the casing was ripped into pieces. I think one, or if not both, of the 20mm aircraft guns were ripped off. One was just hanging about. We could not explain what caused that. I remember clearly after we came into Kiel, there was obviously an inquest, and I remember the end result was that it was decided it must have been a floating wreck, or part of a ship, you know, beneath the surface, the water surface, which you can't hear, you cannot see, and we went underneath it, and that caused the damage.
And that was on the way back from
Hela submarine
training. That
was on the way back to Kiel, yes.
And that's January 1944.
That sounds right. That sounds right.
Now, one thing I'd missed out, but which was upsetting for you, was the death of your father in November
43.
Well, tell us about that. I don't want to upset you, but I mean, it was bad news for you while you were in such circumstances.
Yes. Well, we got our regular post from home. And on this particular day, I received a telegram from my mother. it just said very briefly, "Father dead, please come home at once, mother." At first, it didn't sort of sink in. You read it, but it doesn't really sink in. So I went to the captain. I showed him the telegram. He tried to comfort me. He right away arranged for me to have 3 or 4 days compassionate leave. He arranged for my train ticket and the necessary paperwork. I remember I couldn't sleep that night. Obviously I was upset. I cried. My mates were very understanding, and the next day when all the paperwork was in order, the crew made a collection of money. I don't know how much it was, but it was quite a good, you know, bit of money, which they gave to me and saying, you take this and you give it to your mother, you know, to help with the expenses, funeral or whatever. So I went, you know, I have to be quite honest, I have got no idea whatsoever, no recollection how I got home. I just remember I arrived home. It is a very, very long journey from the Hela Peninsula to my hometown in Erfurt, which is more or less in the center of Germany. I know we went through Berlin, I remember that. Probably most of the time I was sleeping anyway. I have got no recollection whatsoever. I got home and I went to our house. I remember my two little brothers were there, mother was there. Well, there was a lot of crying and hugging and things. And the actual funeral, which was a cremation, was fixed for the following day. We didn't have a local crematorium. It was sort of in the next big town, about 12 kilometers away from where we lived. So we all went there in the car, you know, these funeral cars, and there was the cremation. There was a short ceremony. I cannot remember really very much about it, if anything at all. It wasn't very long, it was short. My father wanted to be cremated, and he stipulated his ashes were to be sort of spread wherever. He didn't want any big fuss about anything. Well, afterwards, we went back home. Of course, there were other members from the wider family there, some aunts and uncles and some other relatives, who by the evening had to go home as well. I can't remember really anything else. But I had these 3 days. I think one day I had to travel there, one day I had to travel back. 4 days, yes, and I was these 2 days at home.
Obviously very, very upsetting indeed.
Well, it was upsetting. Perhaps the good thing was that, you see, even you knew what has happened, you experienced what had happened, but for some reason the reality didn't sink in at that time. That came later. I don't remember much going back to the Hela Peninsula. I remember the trains were full, and at times we had to stand. Trains were late, obviously old steam trains in those days. So I got there, I reported back. And I just went again into the daily routine, which perhaps was good because it took your mind off a lot of thinking. By the time you completed your day's work, as it were, you were tired. And you gradually got to realize Father wasn't anymore. And that was it, you see.
Now, the other thing, you seem to have done a radar course during the time at Hela, you know,
Yes, that was.
This is your first introduction to radar, isn't it?
That was a kind of a radar, yeah. To nowadays comparison, it was very primitive. We had to go, the three, or possibly all five of them, you know, we were three ordinary junior radio operator, of which I was one, and we had two senior radio operators. And we had to go for a radar course in a place called, in Belgium, or is it Holland, Belgium, Den Haan, I think it was called. It was sort of a kind of a school. We were instructed on that device. It was very primitive. It was visual and also hearing. You know, you heard a sound, which means you knew that you were being detected. And you also had sort of a small apparatus with a screen in the middle where a sort of zigzag flickered up and down and up and down. It was very primitive, and you were just told what it meant, what you had to look and listen for. And we had a very short instruction actually on the layout of the device. You know, you get a plan. It was, to my mind, completely useless, because what did we understand about capacitors and valves? And we just didn't understand it. But we had to go through that, and then we went back to the Hela Peninsula.
Anything else while you were at Hela? You seem to have been... You had your damage repaired, and then you seem to have gone
the
back
damage,
to here.
The damage was repaired in Kiel. That means the boat was in dry dock.
Then you do some more sea trials, that's what
we had been given, actually, holiday leave. Half of the crew could go on leave. When we came back, the other half of the crew went on leave whilst the boat was repaired. I can't remember how long that took. It must have taken quite a few weeks.
Now, another thing that I've just picked up from, you know, I'm looking at your account as we go along. Mm. You had to act as officer servants as well as wireless
operators. Oh, yes.
Can you tell us about that?
The wireless operators, because they obviously were the cleanest. You know, we didn't have to muck about with grease and oil and machinery. We were always the cleanest. We were sort of Batman to the officers, which means we had to... The one that means the three junior, not the senior ratings. It didn't have to do that. It was the three junior. One of them was usually on duty somewhere in the radio room or in the listening room, and the other two, who were off duty, had to take it in turns to serve the officers with the meals, whether it was breakfast or dinner or.
You wouldn't have to cook them.
Oh no.
So what did you do? You
well you had certain vessels which you took into the kitchens. You had to go through the control room into the kitchen to get all the food, whatever it was, then take it to the offices. They had a little cupboard with plates and cookery and things and cutlery in there. They laid the table themselves, and we just had to take the food there. Then they had their meal, and when it was finished, we had to take the plates and the, you know, dirty dishes, whatever, and we had to wash them up and put them back in the shelf.
Now, did you have to tidy their quarters and sort of do their uniform, or was that it?
No. Only to do with food. Nothing else at all. No.
Now, anything else you remember before you left Kiel? Because you're at Kiel until April 44.
Mm. Well, when the repairs were completed, we obviously had to go out on trials again. Everything had to be tested. And I think as we were in Kiel, in the bite of Kiel, we had to also do these deep diving exercises just to make sure, you know, that everything is okay, everything works. Usually with personnel from the shipyard on board. And they made notes and possibly afterwards things which were not quite right had to be rectified. The usual procedure. The day came when the boat was declared seaworthy. And then the day came when we took our provisions.
Now, what would provisions be? Who would do it? Would the dockyard mates do it, or would you?
No, we did it. All the stuff was delivered to us in boxes, in tins, in nets, in whatever. And the whole crew was involved in getting all the provisions down into the different places. I don't know whether you have ever seen pictures. You had baskets of loaves of bread hanging from the ceiling here and there. You had sides of bacon hanging here and there. Every nook and cranny was filled with something. The important thing was fresh food like potatoes, you know, greenery, cabbages and so, bread. That was obviously used up first, because when you're actually in action on the submarine, the damp in the submarine, everything went rotten very, very quickly, especially bread, fruit. So that was sort of consumed first. Yeah, that was the provisioning was everybody available had to help.
Now, before you set off for your first, you know, active service mission, were you yourself nervous? How did you feel in yourself?
In myself, I do not think I was nervous. I mean, we knew that the day came when we had to go out first time into action. Of course, once the provisioning was done, we also were given all the armaments, and torpedoes were loaded. Underneath the wireless room, you know, there was sort of a flap in the floor, and underneath there was all the ammunition for the anti-aircraft guns stored, including spare pistols for what do you call this? Shooting the air with the different lights. What do you call this?
Very lights, or
yeah, very light pistols. All that. That was all stored in there, and one of the artifiers was in charge of the ammunition.
Now, before you set off, were you aware of the number of submarine losses? Because the losses were increasing in 43, weren't they? 44, weren't, especially 44.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that?
No, I wasn't aware of it. No. All we were told on that and that time, when everything was complete, we had orders to go so-and-so. No, I myself had... No, it was just, you know, it was just a day's work, as it were.
So you set off on 29th of April, 1944.
Something that sounds right, yes.
Now, what do you remember of leaving port? Was there any send-off or anything?
There was a send-off. There was the usual officers, admirals, or whoever they were. The usual farewell. Music playing, the usual music, marches, and boom, boom, boom. The music sort of we were used to, and then we just sailed. And that, if I remember rightly, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because that was a usual time to sail.
Why? Any reason for
why?
That?
Because, you know, it was towards evening, towards darkness coming. And also, as soon as you leave your base, the time in the submarine changes round. in other words, midnight became midday, where you had your dinner. Evening was breakfast time. See what I mean? The whole routine was turned completely round, so which took 1 or 2 or 3 days to get adjusted to.
So you reversed the daily routine?
It was a reversal of the daily routine, yes.
Did you find that difficult to get used to in those first couple of days?
A bit unusual, I would say. A bit unusual, but not difficult. I mean, you were young. You were always hungry. When there was something to eat, you were eating it. We sailed, I think, through the, what's it called, the Great Belt. You know, there are three ways from the Baltic to go into the North Sea. And we took one of them along the Danish coast into the Skagerrak and the Kattegat, Jutland, it was known. We went through there and we went into the southern part of Norway. There was one place was called Arendal. Why we went there, I don't know, but
that's Norway.
That is Norway, yes.
Now, you seem to have been there a couple of weeks. You know, was anything happening?
Nothing was happening, no. On the way, we had the usual trials, you know, diving, alarms, exercises, whatever. And
everything was running smoothly.
Everything was running smoothly.
Can I ask you, we sort of picked these questions up. So we looked at the officers. What about the NCOs or the senior wireless ratings and and the others, the junior ones? Mm. Do you remember these men? How did you get on with them? Or were there any characters amongst them that you remember?
We got very well on with them. I mean, they were, of course, like every one of us, they were individuals. They had their own ways. They had their own duties to perform, of course, therefore had their own orders to give. We got used to each other. We knew the different characters. We knew how they perhaps would react to what had taken place. If you had done something not quite right, some told you off in one way, some told you off in a different way. But you got used to it and you took it. That was the way it was. And what we knew we had to do, we had to carry out orders. And we never really queried.
Do you remember any of their names, the senior wireless operators? Or it doesn't matter if you don't, but
No.
Now, what about your fellow junior, you know, wireless? You know,
we were three of them, more or less the same age. The oldest one was called Benno. He came from East Prussia, which was sort of a part of Germany before the war. You know, you had to go through the Polish corridor into East Prussia. He still belonged. He was a very nice man, very nice bloke. And then came me, according to age. And then came the youngest one. His name was Karl Heinz. He was okay. He was a ladies' man. He liked girls. And he used to talk a lot about girls. At that time, I wasn't terribly interested in girls. I was more interested in anything to do with the Navy and the sea. Yeah, we got on very well. We've never had arguments.
What about with the rest of the crew? Because sometimes, you know, because wireless operators are a bit of an elite. I mean, how did you get on with the rest of the crew?
Well, we were actually called the elite of the fleet. I don't know why, but we were just as silly as all the others, I suppose.
Were you proud of that status then or now?
We were a little bit proud. I would say yes, in a sense that you had been given that title, intelligence of fleet.
Now, how did you get on with the men then? You know, the ones who weren't wireless operators. Did you get on well with them, or did they resent you?
No, as a whole, no. There was no resentment. No, we all knew and recognised through the training period. We were all in the same boat. Finally, isn't it? It's a pun. We all depended on one another. We all had our duties, jobs to do, whatever they were at the time, and we just did them. Now we had no arguments, I can remember.